Hi, this is Alex Swatz with another episode of the Endofunctor podcast. Today we have James, who is the CEO and co-founder of Category Labs, aka the Monad team. James, before you were working on Monad, you were in high frequency trading. What got you into that?
Just kind of by chance. So I had joined Goldman in 2010, just wanted to get in finance. Always had wanted to be in finance, but the financial crisis 2008 kind of like re-spurred my interest and applied to Goldman, did like technology sort of team at first, exchange connectivity, market data, all that sort of stuff. Built the next generation. I mean, me along with many other people built the next generation of sort of the high performance system, but also super reliable. Banks are very different than like HFT, which you don't really care that much about reliability of the trading strategy in HFT, but you know, banks are handling other people's orders. And so we built like this super as high performance as you can get, but while also being like crash tolerant sort of thing. And so then I wanted to move more to the business side of things. And so, was allowed to move to the equity derivatives desk trading team as a technology person. So, you know, I spent a couple of years there and a recruiter called me and said, "Hey, do you want to interview for this company called Jump Trading?" Had never heard of Jump Trading. You know, a lot of people back then even were not aware of it. And I said, "Yeah, what the heck?" And went over and to their office in Manhattan, interviewed. It was like right before Christmas. So I was like right on my way to like travel for the holidays and that sort of thing. And while I was on holiday, they called me and said, you know, made me an offer basically and joined the team. So it wasn't really intentional at all. I just kind of fell into it. I liked that the environment was, you know, HFT is very academic sort of environment. It's very different than, so I struggle with that as well on both sides. I sat on the trading floor at Goldman with people yelling and screaming at each other and swearing at each other and all that sort of stuff. And you go to like a place like Jump, it's very quiet, like academic sort of environment. But yeah, it was not intentional at all. Like I know a lot of people have kind of intention of doing that, but yeah, just fell into it.
That's really cool. Like when you were at Jump, was there anything in particular that they were headhunting you for?
So Jump is just, a lot of firms like banks and other trading firms, they have a team per sort of a product, but Jump is different. It has a bunch of teams inside and they can all trade the same products and compete with each other. And so there was a trading team that the owner had like basically more or less disbanded, but was reformulating it. And Keone had been hired to that team, I don't know, 3 to 6 months before me. So Keone was already on that team when I joined. He interviewed me actually that day that I came in the Jump office. And there were a few other people on that team. And so at that time, that team wasn't really trading any significant size. There was no really strategies or stuff, you know, fully baked out. And so we just started building, and some of the stuff that I started working on initially was just a research platform. You know, you have like you have a bunch of research boxes, a grid is what they call it, right? And you want to capture data, you do alpha generation, you capture signals, you fit models over those signals, you do sort of like parameter tuning, all this sort of stuff. So that's kind of like what I started with when I first joined.
How many parameters did you guys have going at the end for your models?
So there's teams that have really established sort of signals that like they've hand coded them, and you know the more powerful sort of the better signals you can kind of do like a linear fit across them, and you sort of so they're like very performance. And then if you can't come up with signals, then you sort of go more the deep learning sort of thing. Like you try to get the machine to do more of the work for you. So, you know, we kind of did both ways, but we were a newer team. We were a reconstituted team, basically reborn team. And so we didn't have those years of sort of like hand coded high quality signals. So you know, we always kind of fell back to trying to put more of the burden on sort of machine learning. You know, we use TensorFlow and these different sort of machine learning frameworks, SciPy and all. Yeah, I'm even forgetting now. It's been a long time that I used to. It's been a while now that I've done this stuff. But tree models, all those different sort of Python frameworks, and come up with different things. And the number of signals, I can't remember. We were, you know, performance. Our training team was better at sort of execution than actual like alpha. And so you have teams that are really good at alpha, but not that great at execution. And the better you are at alpha, the less performance sensitive you are, because you can predict farther out. And, you know, other people don't sort of see that. And so they're not competing with you on the execution. But our team was better skilled at execution. And so we're more latency sensitive. And so we're focused on performance a lot. But yeah, you get this kind of wide sort of spectrum of teams, even within Jump, that are good at different sort of aspects of the system.
When it comes to like execution versus, I guess, like alpha or like strategy or something like that. Like what you're saying really resonates with me. I guess my follow-up question would be like, if your edge is execution, how much of that edge is based on like your research, like the signals on the way in, versus how much of it is just like having like the fastest pipes to wherever it is that you're trading?
Yeah. And I posted a tweet about this. It's like the smart people are trying to get faster and the fast people are trying to get smarter. Right. And so if your edge is like latency and you're extremely fast and you're like the Jumps of the world and you have the fastest microwave towers and you have the fastest connectivity and you have the fastest sort of everything's trading strategy, FPGAs, you have all the works of like, where can we cut out all this sort of latency? Then you're trying to get smarter. So you're trying to like leverage that latency, that execution capability better and put, you know, maybe take more risk or have more sort of like strategies running. So you can, you know, you get the sort of better sharp and all that sort of stuff. And then the smart people they're hiring the technology people. They're trying to get faster. You know, can we start an FPGA team and they'll build an FPGA gateway for us, so we'll be faster. And, you know, this is always kind of like the debate in the industry. I think the way it worked out is really the fast people got smarter, rather than the other way around. It's sort of hard. I've seen like some friends went from Goldman to some of the smarter sort of firms, and they were trying to build out these execution teams, and they just were never as successful as like Jump in getting the latencies down. And so everybody's trying to improve on the thing that they're not as good at. And our trading team in particular was, you know, one of the fastest teams at Jump latency wise. And Jump is one of the fastest firms in the world. So we were like one of the fastest teams in the world. And we're always trying to get faster, but it's also a race down to like single digit sort of nanoseconds, some places like CME, where, you know, how much lower can you get? Right. And then you start playing these sort of tricks, like trading off things that you don't even, there's no even data. You haven't even looked at the packet yet. I don't even know what the symbol in the packet is, but I'm still firing an order. And it just gets kind of crazy at that point.
That's interesting. So is the right way to think of it that like execution edge has like a slower decay because of like all the infrastructure, than like smart based edge, which, you know, you can just get people to move from like, you know, firm to firm, or it's like easier to replicate.
Yeah. I mean, some is just capital intensive. Like if you wanted to start an HFT firm today and you wanted to build a microwave network that was competitive with a place like Jump, like that's just a huge sort of capital investment. And so I don't know what it would cost. It would, you know, maybe even be in the hundreds of millions of dollars to build such a thing. And so there is some level of commoditization to some of this stuff, but it's never going to be the top, right? And so you have these you do have these firms that are like trading adjacent. They're technology firms, but they're, you know, they're building sort of microwave towers and then they sell that. But there's also, because they're sort of a generic provider, there's, you know, you're competing with other users of the same system, because, you know, who gets onto the tower first, like whose packet gets on the tower first. And so there's all these sorts of, you're never going to equal your own system. You're never going to equal owning your own system, basically, as a shared user was another thing. So, it's hard. You get these sort of like little upstart firms in Chicago where you get like five guys together and they build an FPGA and it trades this one specific product and it makes enough money for them to all, you know, do well in life. But, they're not going to compete with Jump on any sort of like scale.
Makes sense to me. I think it's like really interesting in particular with crypto where, and just DeFi in general, where the there's this like sense of a lot of the opportunities being more capacity constrained. And so when we look at some of these larger teams, like the big name teams from like, you know, TradFi, and are wondering like why aren't they just coming in and dominating? It's like, on one hand, I think, you know, the regulators are definitely a concern, but on the other hand, it's not clear to me, and I would love your take on this, but like, it's not clear to me that there's enough money in DeFi yet to really support, like to your point, like, you know, like a really, really large team. Whereas like, you know, some, you know, 5-man or 10-man teams, or even just like 1-man teams can, you know, live very comfortably. Is that something that you think is relevant in the DeFi world? Or, and more importantly, do you think that if that is the case, do you think that it'll continue like that?
Yeah. Sort of many thoughts on this. You know, even in TradFi, you kind of have the situation where people are capturing flow, right? Citadels of the world, the Susquehannas. So that's more like BD, right? That's not even trading. It's like, hey, Fidelity, will you route your orders through me? You know, and we'll come to some sort of like fee structure and we'll give you a certain amount of price improvement. And, you know, we were doing this even at Goldman, as at Goldman with expertise was not sort of like the low touch, you know, electronic flow, but, so that's kind of a BD thing. And so you produce reports and you say, hey, Fidelity, we gave your average customer this much price improvement and you got this fee, you know, rebates and all this sort of stuff. And so that's kind of BD. And that stuff never really touches the public markets. And so then what are you left with? Then you're left with like stuff that hits the public markets. You know, then you're trying to trade against is some of that toxic, you know, because if you're smart and you're doing like high touch or low touch flow, you don't really want to trade against the toxic stuff. You route that to the public market. So that's another thing we did, right? Like we classify flow, not necessarily the user, because I think there were some compliance issues with that. You classify flow and you route that to the public market if it's toxic. And so then how do the people who are trading on the public market sort of deal with that? And so how does that affect sort of crypto? I don't know. I'm just trying to like think on the fly here. Like how does that sort of fit in? And if you were to start a trading team on crypto, like where would you go? Like your benefit, you probably want to start like going to wallets or other, you want to kind of get the funnel in from the retail. Like retail is the juiciest flow. And so I don't know. Like, what do you think?
I think it really depends on how from my point of view, it depends a lot on how the blockchain is designed. And so I think that like, you know, speaking as someone in the MEV space, I think that like the way that it panned out on Ethereum, where you have exactly what you're describing with the, you know, basically BD driven, you know, flow acquisition, which I think the Cowspot team actually released a research report the other day that said that, I could be wrong. I could be misremembering, but I think it was like 85% of which block builder won the block auction was based off of their private order flow, which means that 85% of being a good block builder I'm oversimplifying, but 85% of being a good block builder meant like having good BD, which is kind of bearish for Ethereum, I think. But like, then you look at Solana and it's like totally different, because in Solana, it's less about like capturing the flow on the way in and more about like, you know, is Jito going to be running a private mempool? And, you know, do you know any validators on the transactions path to the leader that will leak the transaction to you? And so it's kind of like the BD becomes a little bit more involved, where you have to, you have like multiple ways to capture the, or listen to the transaction. And so this is actually a perfect segue for questions about Raptorcast. And so like with Monad right now, it's my understanding that like, you know, the transactions are right now, it's a very, maybe not how it's going to be in the long term, but the transactions just like they hit a node and then the node just beams it straight to the leader. And so I guess like my question for you is, in the context of MEV and order flow, you know, how are you guys thinking about like Raptorcast and transaction propagation to the leader?
Yeah, so the way the system is right now is you connect to an RPC node and submit your transaction. Obviously, trading firms, once the code is open source, will have their own sort of routing. They may not even use RPC, right? They may send directly to the leader, whatever allows them to track the leader schedule. And this is what we did. This is what I did for Pith with Solana. Is like we would, you know, we'd predict what the leader is going to be. And then we'd send it to like the next two leaders in front of him, the projected leader, and then maybe minus one in case the chain is actually slower than what we view it as. And so you're kind of spamming, you know, a few leaders at once. And then there's additional spamming because I'm not sure what the current Solana architecture is, but there would be forwarding on Solana as well. And so the current system for Monad is very similar to that. You send, you know, stuff to an RPC, which is usually just a full node that's tracking the chain. It kind of has a view on what the next leader is going to be. It has a local mempool, and it basically sends that transaction to the projected leader. I'm not sure if we hit a couple leaders at once, or if we just hit one. But that leader has some time to build a block, because I mentioned recently in one of the Twitter threads related to this Derby sort of race, was we have this kind of timer in there that's slowing Monad down. And so you have this, this sort of 500 millisecond block time that's due to this sort of vote pacing mechanism. And so the leader does have some time to send out the proposal, and it's building the block entirely. So it's not like Solana, or maybe I'm not sure if there's other chains do this, where you can start sending part of the block while you're still building the rest of it. Right now, it's all encoded and treated as sort of an atomic chunk of data, and we raptor encode it, and then it gets broadcast to the other validators, basically. Your question was about MEV. I think, yeah, I mean, naturally, if you're running a validator, you know, you're going to want to maximize your revenue. And how do you do that? You sell preferential sort of access to that block space. Yeah.
One of the things I always found interesting is that like on Ethereum, the validators have opted in to proposer builder separation, which means that the validators don't really see any of the private transactions until after they've already signed the block. So they're kind of like opting in to basically allowing like intermediaries, the block builders to like the block builders would be internalizing the value. So like the value kind of like leaks out of the system. And I've always found that interesting, because as more and more order flow becomes private, I think on Ethereum it's more than 50% right now. It just seems like opting into like not looking at the transactions as a validator is like less and less profitable in expectation. Meanwhile, on Monad, like you guys are way too fast to even consider something like full-blown PBS, where you like the validators basically like, you know, sign off on a transaction, then there's or on a block, then there's like a, they get a block, they sign off on it, then there's a delay, and then they actually see the block like a second later. That's like two whole blocks in Monad time. And I've always found that fascinating. And I think like in that sense, the validators definitely will have, well, maybe not definitely, but I imagine the validators will have the ability to like send out the transactions, in which case the validators could be accruing any of the value there as long as there's time. But I think that the time that they have to do that is something that is going to be really, really interesting to watch. And like the other thing too, and I guess this is more of like a direct like Monad architecture question, is that like right now, every RPC basically has a UDP, like they know exactly how to get to the leader. Is that like, is that safe from like a DDoS standpoint, or is that something that's going to continue to persist? Or are you guys looking at something similar to Solana where you've got like the stake weighted QoS? So where like, you know, if you're an RPC, you send to, you know, someone that has like a lot of stake, and then they'll send it to like, you know, the leader, et cetera, so that you can avoid having to shed transactions at the ingress.
Yeah. In relation to MEV stuff, I think like the short, like you still, if there's more demand than there is supply for the block space, then you want some sort of auction, right? You want some sort of process there. And some, any sort of auction requires some amount of time. You know, even if it's down to you compare everything, every other transaction pairwise with the, you know, like it doesn't matter. You need some sort of, you can imagine blocks where every block is one transaction, right? Like that would be the perfectly streaming case where there is no actual aggregation of transactions together at all. But you need some window of time by which people, you can run some sort of auction process. And so can you drive that down to like zero? Probably not, but lower block times do make it harder to play these sort of timing games. I'm not a super expert at all the MEV stuff, but you know, my understanding is like the longer the auction window, everybody kind of sends their stuff right at the end of the window anyways, because they want to maximize how much information they're making their decision based off of. And so, you might as well just sort of compress these windows. And I think we, based on sort of that recent sort of discussion and talking with the team, like we have this sort of artificially slowing of the Monad chain, you know, we can remove some of that and compress these windows even more. Your question about DDoS, yeah, if you have a port open to the internet, people can blast it, right? Like that's true of sort of any service. I'm sure a lot of chains could be DDoSed even now if you just sort of were strategic and blasted them, you know. I think historically on like Solana, that's been unintentional. There's been like NFT mints, and there were sort of this example where people were just trying to like blast the chain with tons of stuff. And then you had some amplification effects with the forwarding, for example. You had some things that maybe could have done, like the cheaper operation could have been done first instead of the expensive operation. Like you do signature recovery or verification before you do transaction deduplication, right? So you want to flip that sort of like dedupe stuff earlier, do the cheap sort of verifications first. So, you know, we think through all those sort of things. But ultimately, I think like if somebody's blasting you, you just have to, that's also kind of like a network thing, just cut them off. You know, it's not, this is not sort of like provably Byzantine behavior. You just, your recourse is just to basically throw a firewall rule sort of up and block them. But if you know, with a strategic sort of botnet or something like that, I think a lot of chains right now could be easily DDoSed. And so, yeah, I'm not trying to play it down like it's not an issue. It is an issue, but it's an issue that I think the industry kind of faces in general and just needs to get better at, think of ways of handling that. I don't think we have thought about sort of like the ingress being purely from other validators and kind of feeding that. I think kind of validators really shouldn't be subject to, you know, sort of incoming traffic. Like I would not run a valuable staked validator with an RPC node running on the same box open to like customers, because you're like putting your stake at risk for people to submit transactions. So these functions should be sort of isolated.
That makes sense. I recall one of the L2s ended up getting overwhelmed. I don't even think they were getting spammed. It was just that the bots would just monopolize all of the possible connections that were available to the sequencer. And because it was just a, you know, typical centralized single sequencer L2, no one could really get any transactions in because all of the connections were taken up by the bots. And so the L2 in question had to, you know, take some steps. And I think that it'll be really interesting to see if something like that manifests with like the largest stake validators in Monad. I'm not sure. Would something like that even be possible with the architecture?
Well, the only person who, the only validator that's receiving, should be receiving like transactions is the leader, the current leader. There's no point in sending a transaction to another validator because they just ignore it. They're not the leader. There's no reason for them to be receiving transactions. So I'm not sure that that's strictly true. I'd have to chat with the team, like what is the window by which, you know, cause you're not sure, like you might allow some tolerance of like accumulation of new transactions when you're about to become the leader. I'm not sure what that tolerance is, but like I said, if I were running a validator that had any significant stake on it, I would only participate in consensus. I would not, you know, accept inbound except from other sort of staked validators plus the leader, the current leader.
And then, so if you're doing that, then would that imply like the blocks are getting built like externally if they're not getting transactions?
Well, the leader will be receiving transactions.
Ah, got it. So you're saying you would just like immediately reject via firewall, like all transactions, unless you know that you're about to become the leader, or like you are the leader.
Yeah, and I don't think it's in the firewall right now. It's just in the software. It should be at least. I'll have to check with the team. I haven't tracked this completely closely, but you know, like I said, there's probably some tolerance, but like if you're not going to be the leader for 5 minutes, why would somebody send you a transaction? That doesn't make sense, right?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Speaking of like being the leader, so right now there are, oh gosh, actually, I don't even know what the new number is because I know you guys just added a whole new set of validators. I think it was yesterday. Are there plans to make the validator set permissionless?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So the staking module, which, you know, staking and delegation and all that stuff will be built in. It's just not in the current release. And so absolutely, it'll be permissionless. I'm not even sure what cap the initial sort of thing at. You know, you don't want somebody who throws one mon on a validator to be able to be on the leader schedule. It just consumes a bunch of resources for like what purpose? What are you achieving? So there has to be some cutoff. I think for mainnet, you know, like as we've said in other places before, targeting couple hundred validators and then going to up to Solana and Ethereum sort of level of thousands. The problem with thousands, the main problem as I understand it, is signature aggregation. Like the cryptography is expensive, right? And cryptography is expensive computational wise. It takes CPU time. And so when you start aggregating thousands of signatures together, you know, that takes a long time and that can really slow down what the leader is doing. Although I just heard recently that like, you can get to 2/3 majority on Solana with like 80 validators or something, even though there's like 3,000. So maybe that concern is also not even a valid concern because the distribution of stake is like this basically. Right. And like, you really need this just needs to sum to 2/3. And so maybe if you just kind of ignore, like people send their votes and you just ignore the lower stakes validator vote and you don't even try to aggregate it. You know, you just, I don't know. So there's these sort of games you can maybe play, but I think really realistically you want some sort of solution that can support, you know, thousands of signatures being added to the aggregation. And then you might want to issue rewards, right? You might want to incentivize voting, right?
I think in Solana's new architecture, like their new consensus protocol, Alpenglow, that's actually one of the like problems that they've identified, which is where like the slower validators are not going to get the rewards because they're just going to get cut out of consensus because the faster validators just don't have enough time to give a fuck about about waiting to aggregate their signatures. Like for you guys, like how are y'all approaching trying to determine the correct number of validators? Are you guys like clocking in like how many signatures you can do on, you know, a certain hardware spec, or like how are you guys?
Yeah, absolutely. That? We have just a ton of benchmarks around all these sort of cryptographic primitives, and yeah, that's exactly it. We have benchmarks and they say you can aggregate this many signatures, you can do this much stuff within this amount of time. And then we just, you know, we have a range of times we just pick a number basically and we say, okay, that's the cutoff. So yeah, that's where these sort of numbers come from.
So like speaking of, you know, validators kind of cutting each other out, you know, one of our very good friends is a validator that is currently running in South Africa. And when we are looking at, you know, things like, you know, should we wait around for this, you know, validator in the other hemisphere? You know, the question becomes more about like, for that validator, it's like, you know, yeah, we can wait around for them, but like, why? Because we don't need, you know, the South African validator's votes to get 2/3 consensus, right? And so, like, I guess like my question for you guys is, how are you approaching geographic decentralization? And like, how are you looking at the technology and like, how are you measuring that kind of approach where like you do want a validator like in all of these areas, but like, how are you measure or how are you looking at like, incentivizing or trying to avoid not disincentivizing geographic decentralization?
Yeah, so that was what the vote pacing mechanism was doing. So, you know, imagine you have like 2F+1 are all in, let's say, Europe, right? And you, you know, like the others are in sort of somewhere else, Northeast US, and then everything's running at the speed of Europe, right? For 66% of the time, basically. And then there's some outage, like some data center, like Hetzner goes down or something. Right. And so now the chain, basically that 2F+1 is kind of the speed it's been running at, but then the chain sort of like has to fall back. You need to collect votes from place validators, which are more remote. And so you get in these sort of like situations where the chain starts jumping around and sort of its performance. And, you can even think of sort of Byzantine cases if you take it to the extreme, which I don't think are realistic sort of cases, but you know, you have to build off this sort of situations and like 2F+1 and then like so many are Byzantine and they can kind of like shut down the chain or drop the performance significantly when some of the non-Byzantine kind of slow down. And so you just become less resilient to that. And I think, you could take sort of the approach where you have the best performance in the happy case and your unhappy case is really, really bad. And you're willing to like trade that off a little bit. So, you know, all these things have dials, right? And you kind of turn the dial one way. And I think there is a strong case to be made that really people don't try to interfere with the operation of the chain. Everybody's incentives are generally sort of aligned and you're going to get, you know, you could get end up getting socially slashed anyways. And so what really causes chain outages? It's usually either like misconfigurations by validating companies or bugs in the code by the client maintainers. It's not people really trying to play games. Because why would you even try to do that if you have sort of stake at risk or any sort of thing? What are you going to gain? So I think there's a case to be made. You're trying to turn the dial to yes, let's be even faster in the happy case and accept that in the unhappy case, we'll be really even much worse off. I think that's, you can make good arguments for that. Yeah, how do you do that? I don't know. You want that South Africa validator to be profitable, otherwise they won't run it. and you want to sort of decentralization, global decentralization, for censorship resistance and other sorts of reasons, different governments and all this sort of stuff, right? And you don't want everybody in the U.S. because then you just run a U.S. chain and you're subject to U.S. law and U.S. OFAC and all this sort of stuff. And so how do you make that profitable for them and make it worthwhile for somebody to want to run that down there? And if they can move that node, you know, the internet, you can spin up a node anywhere. I can get a node in Germany in 5 minutes, you know? So like you can spin up, why would I run it in South Africa sort of thing? Even if I'm South African, you know, there's no reason for me to run it locally to me. So it has to be somewhat like equally profitable. I think the foundation can also sort of influence these things via delegation. And, you know, there's social ways of influencing that. Maybe it's less profitable, but the foundation delegates a stake to them to make it profitable, that sort of thing. And so you know, there's other social ways of tuning like the decentralization aspects. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is a hard problem. Like, how do you make that South African vote count? If you reward votes, how do you make that count? I'm not going to make up a solution on the fly, but you know, these are types of things you need to consider, right?
And I like that you guys are actually taking the time to really examine the trade-off space. Cause I get the sense that like these days it seems to be that most of those who would say that they're your competitors are really just like centralized L2s. And so, you know, when I look at the Monad stack, and especially when I look at the parts of it that haven't been launched yet on testnet, it's, you know, like staking and P2P discovery. And then I, you know, will go on Twitter and I'll see some of these, you know, centralized L2s be like, whoa, you know, it's like Monad isn't. And it's because you guys are working on stuff that they've just like given up even trying to solve. And so I find that to be like really interesting where, you know, you guys are really tackling these hard problems, like arguably unsolvable. Like arguably it's, you know, some of these things are more about picking the optimal point on a trade-off spectrum than actually solving them.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. Like we are trying to be a decentralized global network. Now, given that statement, how fast can we possibly be? Like, and others are starting with like, how fast can we be? Well, how fast can you be is to not use blockchain at all. Like, why bother? Like, you know, just buy a data center, put 1,000 servers in there, connect them all using InfiniBand, and you know, no one's going to beat you. Like, no one can compete with that, right? So at Category Labs, we're trying to build like a world-class research team, probably the best research team in the whole crypto space is Ethereum's, right? I think no one would probably argue with that, or Ethereum adjacent sort of organizations. And, you know, Category Labs is trying to build that. And so, you know, we've hired a small but growing team of top-notch researchers, and they sit around and think about this stuff all day and what these different trade-offs that you mentioned. But yeah, L2s are basically to some extent punting they're just punting on these questions. I'm not going to solve that problem. Ethereum already solved it for me, right? Or Celestia or other DA sort of layers. But there's trade-offs there as well. You know, there's differences between EigenDA and Celestia and which do you want to use? I think kind of the play right now these days is to be an L2 and act like you're Ethereum aligned, but actually use like alt sort of DA and all these other sort of layers, right? And so you get the Ethereum people sort of like cheering for you, rah, 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 L2 roadmap, roll-ups, all this sort of stuff. And at the same time, actually, you're not even using really Ethereum at all. You know, your stuff is all outsourced. So these cheaper sort of alt DA layers. And where does sort of Monad land in that? Like, you know, like Tolia said about Solana, like Monad could build a DA sort of layer as part of Monad as well. And we might, but who knows? You know, it's not on our current roadmap. You know,
have you guys like thought at all about or done any research on like once Monad mainnet is live, do you guys have any like economic research or just ideas of how much a transact, like just like a regular transactional cost in US dollar terms?
I don't think so. I think we think some about, I mean, it should be pennies or less than a penny or whatever, but I think we think about for things that are very sort of transient, like, you know, market making orders on a DEX, you know, that should be sort of as low cost as possible. What would it cost a market maker to, you know, place a bunch of orders, 90% of which will never be filled? And that sort of leads to, you know, the cheaper it is for a market maker to basically market make, it leads usually to you know, tighter spreads and that sort of thing, and how fast they can cancel and all this sort of stuff. And so we definitely think about that. I think one of the main problems with blockchain is growth of storage. And so we think about, you know, if somebody really wanted to mess with Monad and they wanted to spend $100,000 just for fun, how much storage could they create? You know, and I think, I don't know, maybe we should take $100,000 and go create, you know, a couple terabytes of storage on another blockchain just for fun and see what happens. But yeah, you know, so you think about sort of those sort of things. I think you want to definitely gear towards, if you have on-chain order books and that sort of stuff, you want to gear towards plenty of sort of storage throughput in terms of like transient data, but not accumulation. And so order books is a perfect example of that. Orders are constantly being placed, canceled, filled, whatever. An on-chain order book is going to go through a lot of storage related transactions, but the actual accumulation is you know, sort of fixed. Like, it's not going to, order book's not going to keep growing indefinitely, right? And so, yeah, it's hard. Like, there's no perfect solution to this stuff. If you try to make something that's not gameable by anybody, you just won't end up making anything at all, right? There's always some design space you're going to miss, and somebody can game it in a certain way. And so, I don't want to pretend that Monad has this problem solved. We have some initial thoughts and some initial ideas, but yeah, we'll see how it plays out.
When it comes to the question of like storage, especially for order books, one of the things that I think is really interesting is the trend that's happening in Ethereum land, where a lot of these DEXs or exchanges, you know, probably not central node order books, but like a lot of these exchanges are converging towards what they're calling a singleton pattern, which is where rather than having, you know, a different pool or a different, like, you know, a pair smart contract deployed for every pair, they'll just kind of take as much as they can and jam it into a single contract. And I guess like my question for you is, in the Monad architecture and like with all the optimizations that you guys have made to like Monad DB, is that something that would be significantly more efficient? Like, or I guess like a better way to frame the question would be, would you rather have 1,000 different like storage slots in a single contract, or like, is there a difference between 1,000 storage slots having a value in a single contract or 1,000 contracts each having a single like storage slot?
Yeah, I think we would have to, I would have to go back and look at some of this stuff in terms of optimization, but I would be more inclined to use more smart contracts. Because then you're sort of like your Merkle try has less depth. And you can kind of cache the pointers to those contracts. And so, well, even for some things internally, I've said, just use more contracts. Like, I want to get the sort of like the delegate call sort of thing where you can accessing the storage in different contracts as cheap as possible, like almost costless. Because then you get sort of like greater sort of address space, right? If you can accumulate, if you can use storage across many contracts, you get kind of a greater address space, and it's just cleaner also from a programming perspective. You don't have to worry about sort of how, you know, where the data structures, collisions and all that sort of stuff. And like Solidity uses a lot of hashing, right? The map, it uses the hashing a lot. Hashing is kind of an expensive operation. It's not super expensive, but it's, you know, you're kind of hashing to jump around within the storage. And so Solidity's, you know, maps and different things are using hashing to like get these different sort of storage locations. And you can avoid all that, right? If you have a more fixed layout, you can kind of write, you know, YULE or whatever, and just avoid all these sort of like jumping around hashing operations. So, my goal is to make, yeah, like I said, smart contract calls as cheap as possible so that you don't fear using 10 smart contracts to store 10 different sort of data structures as opposed to using, you know, just one and kind of cramming it all together. So
that's interesting. So you would rather call an external contract than hash in order to do like namespaced storage, like multiple times in a single contract.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that Monad is optimized for this right now. I'm just stating what my design goal is to make that extremely cheap.
That is so interesting to me. We, as an aside, so our company is we take a lot of logic that's typically found in backends and we put it in smart contracts, which allows us to do some very neat things atomically. And we constantly are butting up against the smart contract size limit. We make aggressive use of delegate call tape. I think like we've got one, our application specific sequencing, for instance, has three nested layers of delegate calls inside of like other delegate calls. And like, so we were like really excited originally about like Monad and the smart contract size increase. We're like, oh, we can take, you know, some of these, you know, fragmented, you know, delegate calls and cram them all together. But what you're saying actually makes perfect sense where it's like, cause yeah, we definitely do namespace the storage. We have like the extra hashing, so that we don't have to do an external call, even if it's just like a delegate call to get the bytecode. You're kind of blowing my mind right now.
Yeah, but don't change it yet because I'm not saying we've implemented this. I'm just telling you sort of where I'm going with it. Right. And it's equivalent to like calling into another function, but getting a new address space for that function. Right. And I actually interviewed somebody today for a category that works on sort of like browser security and stuff. Right. And they are kind of doing that sort of thing where they, you know, the problem with browsers is you have like libjpg, and libjpg is a C library that does image processing. And, you know, the browser calls into that. And if somebody sends a malformed sort of JPEG and there's an exploit, that JPEG has given that hacker attack access to the entire sort of browser space. Right. And so one way they kind of dealt with that is to, and it's just coincidental, this is coming up, but the one way they deal with that is kind of give it a new address space, or they give it an address space that's kind of locked down sort of thing. And so while you can mess around with what's going on there, you can't mess around with the rest of the browser. And he pointed out some Intel CPU architecture stuff that I wasn't aware of. So that was very interesting, but I kind of view this as the same sort of thing. Like it's just, you're jumping to a new address space and a new piece of code for that. You're jumping to a new piece of code and you have a address space for that piece of code. And I think that opens up a lot of things, and just making that sort of jump very, very extremely cheap, or maybe it should cost nothing at all. I don't know.
We make aggressive use of that pattern too. Like whenever we're doing, like a smart contract is scheduling future execution for a future block, that execution is actually coming from gas that is like left over from searchers transactions, which are going in through our MEV entry point smart contract. And so the idea is that like, you know, we're getting hit with all this, you know, spam from searchers. Let's just put that gas to good use because they've paid for it anyway. You know, cause we can't like, you know, fully refund all of their gas. So we're just going to, you know, repurpose it. And so the idea is we have to use one of those, new address, spaces, cause we don't want to have whoever like queued up this task. We don't want to give them access to the searcher or the bots like smart contract. And so we actually create a brand new smart contract for each task. So it has its very own, like, you know, storage space and domain space, and then it delegate calls another contract to get its like actual like bytecode for like, you know, function execution and stuff like that. And right now it costs us roughly 120,000 gas to create one of these things. Maybe more, maybe less. Smart contract creation is exponential with the length of the constructor. And yeah, dude, oh man, if you guys can shorten that, would make
so,
my day.
So you're creating a smart contract on the fly that then is destructed afterwards?
So the way that it works is that, like, if like let's say you've got a DEX and you want to do a dollar cost average, you might the transaction might do the first buy at atomically at the time of, and then it would schedule a task to do recurring future buys. And in order to schedule that task, that scheduling process will actually create a brand new smart contract. And what then happens is whenever MEV bots are doing MEV bot things, their leftover gas will then get used to call the, we call it the task manager. It'll call the task manager, which is like effectively a queuing and load balancing system, which will then call whatever the smart contract is that is the task, and then the task will execute. But we have to use that like brand new smart contract in order to make it so that like people know who the task is. Like they're like, hey, I'm getting called by this address. That means it's this task, and it'll behave predictably. And then it'll like, there's not any risk of like someone else just like, you know, going into Yule or assembly or whatever and like changing up the storage in between. Like it's not like a shared thing. It's its own thing because the task mm-hmm. can have like arbitrary, you know, bytecode.
And so, and when is that smart contract cleaned up then, when that dollar cost average process is done?
So you're not going to like the answer to this, but never, because there's no financial incentive for us to actually clean it up. It'll just be a smart contract that just exists forever, increasing the state. If there's an incentive for us to destruct it, we certainly will. But
okay, now we'll add an incentive. is it accumulating storage as well? Because
it could.
In this case, storage will probably be, in Monad's case, storage will probably be expensive, right? And then it'll be refundable. So that's the only way you can kind of incentivize people to clean up stuff. And I actually hadn't even occurred to me, I traded a bunch of meme coins on Solana. And I went the other day, well, this was a while ago, but I went through and like deleted all these sort of zero balance meme coins that I had traded. And I got back a bunch of Sol. And I was like, wow, this is really cool, right? All the Sol was sitting out there. I had no idea. And so, yeah, I definitely need something like that on Monad where the storage and I think that's kind of where we're heading with this is, you know, refunds and that sort of thing.
I was actually talking with, I think Mike is his name. I'm not sure if you guys were aware of this, but a long time ago in Ethereum land, there used to be a coin that was, in essence, like if you had one of these, for every one coin, there was a smart contract that had been created during a very low gas price period.
Yeah.
And the way the coin worked is like you could just use the coin to trigger the self-destruction of a smart contract. And so the idea is like you would buy these coins and they would basically get converted into refunds that you would use during like everything but like the lowest gas price period. I can't remember the name of the coin.
Yeah, there were games with Ethereum where you could basically purchase storage while storage was cheap and then destruct it when gas was expensive and basically earn money by this game. So no, yeah, we're aware of that, and definitely the Monad will be. You won't be able to game the storage to earn.
That is really cool. Like we'll be sure to like do whatever is the most like economically like feasible. We like a lot of this stuff from our point of view, we kind of have like an asterisk next to a lot of the designs because we know that like. The transaction fee mechanism, for instance, is still like unfinalized, I should say. And so like, you know, things like right now, one of the biggest differences between Monad and other L1 EVM blockchains is that on Monad, someone does a transaction, they pay the gas limit in full rather than how much gas they used. And we understand roughly why. But at the same time, you know, we're kind of operating under the assumption that like that might be changed or adjusted in the future to something more granular. But I would love to learn more about like your thoughts on how you guys are looking at the incentives in the transaction fee space.
Yeah, so there's a bit I can say on this. So even though Monad has asynchronous execution, right, you still try to execute as quickly as possible. So when a validator receives a proposal, it tries to execute it right away. The delayed execution is more so that the two processes can be pipelined, but it's not an actual delay. Like it doesn't sit and wait. It's never waiting. It's always trying to go as fast as it possibly can. And so for any decently spec'd node, it'll always be caught up. Like as soon as that validator receives the proposed block over consensus over Raptor Cast, it'll decode it and execute the transactions right then. Now it doesn't know if that block's finalized or anything, but it still has the pending sort of like proposed state changes, right? And you know, the next block may be a fork or something. Like it may not actually be maybe the same block. Next proposal may be for the same block that the previous proposal was for or something, because that one doesn't end up getting finalized. And some of that's changing with the Monad BFT paper. And, you know, we're making all that sort of like less likely. So there's less tail forking sort of possibility. But yeah, the async, I think sometimes people are confused with delayed execution or async execution, that there's actual some sort of delay. There's no actual delay. The delay is where consensus and execution kind of reconcile what the gas usage was of the transactions and all that sort of thing. And so there was this debate on knowing that most validators are going to be on decently powered hardware and all this sort of stuff, the execution would always be cut off. There was this debate on like, will validators be able to simulate the transactions before they create the block? And in practicality, they probably will be able to, because they will be caught up and they'll have all the previous information for the previous block, right? So, you know, that's a likely case, right? And you look like you have a question, so let's stop there.
I'd take the other side of that bet, actually. I would take the other side of that bet. If the validators had a choice, they would probably not, because as you were mentioning earlier, the like MEV transactions, like the high value transactions, are typically coming in as late as possible, but they're also at the top of the block. And so in order for a validator to go all the way through the entire block, like once they start building the full block, that means they have to stop like taking transactions. And like, you know, as they're building it, once like, you know, the first five transactions are like fully built, then they can't put another one at the top. And so the sooner they start like actually executing the full thing, the sooner they'll have to stop taking high value MEV transactions. But you could like enforce this at a consensus level, I think, and make that not a problem at all.
But you could always pre-execute, right? And then you keep like what is touched. And so like, I have to imagine a good portion of the block is sort of you know, across, let's say, different products on a DEX, right? And so those things are not really interacting with each other. So it's not necessarily the case that like rearranging the entire set of transactions means you have to re-execute the block. Like you already have a lot of transactions that you executed right as they came in are probably already not going to affect anything. Me depositing to some protocol that gets used like a couple hundred times a day is not going to interfere with anything happening on like a DEX, right? So that simulation of that transaction won't be invalidated. I agree with you that it's not predictable. So I guess maybe you run out of time because you try to do your best job and then you kind of run out of time and you've made that trade-off already of when to start. I would argue if there's any sort of value in MEV, well, you would just buy bigger machines. Buy a, you know, supercomputer if you have to, and, you know, if it's going to pay off, there's going to be some sort of thing. But yeah, you might be right. Like maybe you do run out of time and you have to form the block without fully executing everything.
I think I don't know if it's like a matter of like right or wrong, because I think you guys can make it however you want to make it, right? So if you guys say like you leave it asynchronous for, and maybe there's a reason that would be blockedness, but like you could leave it asynchronous for everyone else, but then the leader, it's synchronous or something like that. Would that be feasible?
Well, the asynchronous again is always just by which the asynchronous means that the execution has to be caught up to consensus within K blocks. So everything can do what they want. You as a leader could always just construct a block without even doing anything, right? Like, you know, you do the basic sort of validation on the transactions, but you never even look at them. You know, you could do that. It's not optimal. So I think this is more of a question of like what's optimal versus what's required. Like, you know, you have your basic sort of like what is a valid block in Ethereum. You don't have transactions with multiple nonces. The nonces are in order. You know, account balances are there. Like there's no other sort of the requirements to build a valid block are actually pretty low. So, you know, the similar to this sort of thing of what you're saying, there was pushback of like, should a home validator be able to build a block? Like should a minimum sort of resourced node be able to produce a block? And, you know, some people say, no, we don't give a shit about those home people. You know, they can validate the chain because they can run full nodes. So they can still verify that what happens on chain is correct, but they won't, you know, they may not be adequately resourced to produce a block. And then other people will argue that no, a home validator should be able to produce a block. They should still be able to comply with sort of the protocol specification. And that's what I said. We're like, you could produce a block. It may be a really dumb block in terms of how much actual fees it earns, but it's still correct as far as the protocol goes. And so I think we kind of lean that way. And if you lean that way, then yes, you don't know what the gas is used. And so you can't really verify what gas is used. And that's why we went with gas limit. And I actually used to argue against gas limit internally, because as a user of Ethereum, I know there's plenty of times where I've submitted transactions where the gas limit was larger than what the gas actually used was. And, you know, I love seeing on the GUI, like, especially on Pendle, where it's like, you know, you sent $5 worth of gas, but and it comes back, gas use was actually only $3. Ooh, I saved $2. You feel good about it. that sort of thing. And you're like, well, wait a second. You're going to say Monad's just going to charge me the $5. That's not nice. So, you know, I used to argue sort of internally against this, but I think a couple things is, we did look at actual real usage data on Ethereum, and the ones where there's like a big difference between gas limit and gas used, there's just some outrageous sort of cases where I think there's either bugs in the front end of the app, or, you know, there's ridiculous, like there's even transfers where like the gas limit was some ridiculous value, a simple transfer. And like that simple transfer doesn't use any gas. So why would they send this gas limit that's massive? And so I think we found that a lot of the big differences between gas used and gas limit were actually just erroneous behavior. And so that's one thing. The other thing is that Monad generally is expected to be cheap. And so, you know, if the underlying sort of gas in terms of dollars is cheap, does it really matter like which one you sort of charge? Like the practical, you know, is some tiny fraction of a penny between the two values, does it really matter? And so, I think that's kind of where the rationale for just charging gas limit. I don't know if there's a way for us to move away from that or kind of what the strategic plan there is, but that's, as you know, that's the current way it is on testnet, and that's the way the system is still written. Yeah.
And so it's my understanding that like the reason why it is that way is because if you didn't charge on the gas limit, then someone could create a transaction with a really big gas limit, only use a little bit of it, and then you would have blocks that looked full to the validators during like, you know, consensus voting and ratification, but were actually just teeny tiny.
Yeah, that's right. So, we should have started with that at the beginning. I guess we kind of assumed that knowledge and that whole explanation. But yeah, if you don't charge it and you don't execute, then it's gameable.
And so I guess like with the in the context of the like gas refunds for like let's say a smart contract that self destructs after it's no longer needed, or just like, you know, clears itself. The idea would be that rather than reducing the gas that's used of that transaction, you could just do like a refund, maybe like two or three blocks later, something like that.
Or yeah, the like refund. So the storage refunds would obviously have to be outside of that, mechanism. Correct.
Got it.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay.
That yeah. Otherwise, it wouldn't make sense because they wouldn't get anything back. But
makes a lot of sense to me. So. Like one of the interesting, I guess, corollaries there is, and this is one of the things that I love about Monad as a former spammer myself. I get the sense that you're going to, if you're running a bot and that plans to spam, I get the sense that you'll have to have more gas tokens or just more like, you know, mon, in your balance, because if you send like, let's say five transactions a block and then, but maybe you get partial refunds for some of those transactions, but you won't necessarily, as far as the validators are concerned, you won't get those refunds. Like they won't be credited to your balances in terms of like, is this a valid transaction at the consensus level? Is that the right way to think about it?
Right. Like if you sent a bunch of transactions with gas limits, so that let's say you wanted to mint, but you could only like mint one. But you wanted to send five transactions. Like the validators would still be incentivized to include those, because they're gonna get your gas limit even though it reverts early. So you can't do these sort of things where like you say, I'm gonna send a transaction, and the very first thing the smart contract does is check to see if the previous transaction actually fulfilled what I wanted to do. And so you would then send like 5 or 10 transactions all trying to do the same thing. And the validator would either include those and get a very little small reward, or just wouldn't include them at all because it's not worth it total gas wise. But in this case, the validator might just include them all because it's going to collect the gas limit on all of them. And so your total cost of the spammy is, you know, linear with how many you basically sent spam wise. So, yeah, I think it does change some of the dynamics there.
What about a similar scenario, but like let's say you have a transaction and this transaction calls a gas filler contract, and the gas filler smart contract transfers you back a refund of the amount of value that you spent to pay for the transaction. And so at the execution level, you kind of are just constantly have the same balance, but consensus doesn't necessarily execute. The question would be like, so if I only have enough gas for one transaction and I get refill to have that same amount of gas after that transaction by the execution layer, I think like on Ethereum, I could kind of spam a transaction that calls that. But I think on Monad, I'd only be able to send that transaction once every like two or three blocks.
Sorry, I understand what you're saying now. That's correct. Yeah. So you would, that transfer back would not be recognized for the execution delay K, which is set to 3 right now. So yeah, that's correct. You would not, consensus would not see that value replenished until the execution delay. And that's why it's fixed, even though the node may compute it fast, so the validator may know that in 3 blocks, it's getting the value back. It just can't apply that because the nodes have to come to consensus on the result. And that's why you have that fixed sort of. Yeah. That's correct. Yes.
Do you think that's going to impact how HFT teams are looking at like trading on Monad? Or do you think that'll have any sort of implications or side effects for trading behavior?
I don't think so, because I think the active, well, first of all, for even with the current block time of 500 milliseconds for a retail user, that's like 1.5, like K equals three is one and a half seconds. Like, I don't know. Maybe are people clicking that fast? But you know, they should have some, the default reserve balance should be big enough that it covers most user, retail user sort of cases anyways. And so then you get to the HFT firm. Well, I mean, Mana is still relatively cheap. So even a standard sort of reserve balance should be enough to cover, you know, X number of transactions in flight sort of thing. But it should be tunable. So a HFT firm could come in and say, we will change this. We'll do a setting where we actually set it to a higher value. So that they can increase the number of in-flight transactions or, you know, whatever, in-progress transactions.
Cool. Okay, that makes sense. Let me ask you this. Like, with regards to, like, the whole concept of, you know, the consensus accounting versus on-chain accounting, like, one of the things that a lot of EVM chains have been getting really excited about is EIP 7702. EIP 7702, for the people who aren't aware, that are listening, it's a EIP that basically allows just like a regular account, like a regular EOA, to have bytecode. And on most chains, this makes a lot of sense. But the issue on Monad, as I understand it, is that it actually will break, or maybe not break, but maybe intersect in a potentially damaging way with the consensus accounting, because once an EOA has bytecode, that allows other EOAs to call it to transfer its balance or its value out. And so all of a sudden, the consensus algorithm, the validators that are testing on blocks, no longer know if a EOA's balance is what they thought it was. I know this is something that I bug you guys about a lot. I'm not sure if you've seen any of my my asks. I message Candy about this like maybe like once every other week. But like, how are you guys looking at 7702 integration? And if so, is this something that's going to impact consensus?
I don't think it impacts the reserve balance stuff. So the value that can be accessed by the other contract from the EOA is subject to the reserve. So it will not be able to dip into that reserve. So let's say your account balance is 100 and your reserve is the default setting, let's say 10. By the way, I made that number up because I don't know what the reserve setting is going to be, but just for this example, and you are a delegated account, and somebody else calls, sends a transaction which wants to transfer 95 from your account, 95 mon from your account, that will fail. That transfer will fail because it's trying to dip into the reserve balance. So the maximum that other transaction could transfer from your account would be 90, right? Because assuming there hasn't been a recent transaction.
That makes sense. So, I mean, does that mean that you guys are bringing back the carriage cost system? Because that sounds to me a lot like the carriage cost system from a year ago.
It's basically similar, yeah. The carriage cost was never carriage cost. It was just, it was sort of the intrinsic gas of the transaction. But in this case, we're not charging intrinsic gas. We're still charging max gas. As we just discussed, but intrinsic gas thing was you could pay for basically inclusion of a transaction that may never actually run, right? And so that goes kind of back to even sort of like data availability. Like you're paying to post data on the chain, but transaction like immediately reverts right at the beginning or something because there's no gas. So this is still sticking with the max gas, but yeah, the reserve balance applies to the account balance for those delegated sort of transactions.
It's very interesting. Let me ask you this. This is a very nuanced question, but if I were to, inside of the EVM, if I were to have a smart contract and that smart contract just did a, you know, a account.balance of somebody's EOA, would the balance that's returned be the full balance, or would it be just the full balance minus the reserve? Like, does the execution layer see the reserve balance?
Yeah, that's a very sort of, that's a design decision, right? That's a debatable sort of design decision. Should it show what the actual account balance is, or should it show what the available account balance is? I think it should show what the available account balance is, because if you're reading that in a smart contract, you presumably want to do something with that value. And why would you return a value that it can't actually use? So I think it should, I think this is sort of like a place that might be a case where smart contract developers kind of run into on this sort of delegated thing. But yeah, I think the balance opcode should show the available account balance.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah. Are you guys thinking about adding another opcode to see what the reserve balance is?
I don't think we've thought about that. No. So the kind of case where you really want to like dip into the entire balance is like where you want to empty an account, right? You want to like zero out an account. And so we've thought about mechanisms like, how do you detect that, you know, and we can actually spend from the full sort of reserve balance. And there, I think there's some like, sort of heuristics you can use there. Like it, there has like that account hasn't sent a transaction recently, so there's no way that could have been spent from. It's not a delegated account, so there's no way it could have been spent from. And so if you keep all this sort of like recent history and knowledge in your recent knowledge and sort of like your active sort of logic, then you can say, okay, I will accept a simple transfer for this account, which spends the entire balance. And then from that point forward, you know, there's no, you know, the actual spendable is always the minimum of the reserve setting versus the actual account balance. Right. And so if the actual account balance goes to zero, then the reserve is, you know, the spendable is zero. And so there's no real issue after that, I think.
That makes a lot of sense to me. That is so cool. I can't wait for that to hit testnet.
But yeah, I don't know to your question. I'm trying to think on the fly here of a use case of knowing a smart contract, knowing the entire balance, including the reserve, because it can't really action that. So
I can tell you the one I'd use it for, which is okay. We run a lot of like bundlers, which are like using our paymaster, stuff like that. And so if we can see the reserve balance, we can know when to refill or top off the bundlers. And so like, it would be very useful to us for anything involving gas abstraction, where we've got smart contracts that are making it so that our EOAs or our accounts can have their next transaction, like, you know, land successfully.
I see. So you're spending down to the point where the balance, the account balance is getting close to what the reserve setting is. And so you don't know that it's actually being replenished. Is that the,
well, let me actually ask you a question, because I might be looking at this the wrong way. I might have an invalid assumption here. If I do a transaction and I've got, you know, let's say the reserve ratio is 10%. And so I've got, you know, one mon, so 0.9 available on chain, like 0.9 is the, you know, address.balance. And I've got 0.1 in the reserve balance. And I do a transaction that costs like 0.05 mon. Does that 0.05 get deducted from the reserve or from the on-chain balance?
From the reserve.
Okay.
And it would not be replenished for then K equals 3 blocks. So it doesn't matter how much mon you have in your account. It will not, that reserve will not get replenished until execution is executed that block. Or, well, as I said, it executes it real time, but until it communicates with consensus that that's executed.
And when it gets executed, that's when, so for like 3 blocks, I would have like 0.05 reserve and 0.9 on chain balance. And then after three blocks, I would have 0.1 reserve and 0.85 on chain balance.
That's correct.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. But, then actually,
but the balance in our system is the entire balance. So it is that. It's what the balance, like what we store in the Merkle tree for that account, is what the entire balance is. It's not. We don't keep two separate balances, right?
Got
and
it.
So the easy way to see like what your available reserve is just to look at the last K blocks and just sum up all your transactions that you initiated and the gas limit on those and subtract that from the reserve. So yeah, I don't know if you're trying to do it on chain or off chain, but off chain, it's very easy. Like you just look at the box and that's what the client software is doing as well. It's just keeping track of like the last K blocks.
And then on chain, it would just be executing. So it would be looking at the right number anyway.
Yeah. On chain, you would not be able to, on chain with the current design, you would not be able to query how much reserve is left.
Is it like a fixed ratio? If you knew the ratio on chain, could you like backwards calculate from your current balance?
Well, on chain, you don't know like what your recent transactions are. So how would you calculate how much you've spent?
Well, cause you would, you'd be able to look at the balances. So if you knew like what, well, I mean, you could just store it.
Well, yeah, we don't have a way of reading the total balance or the reserve balance. We just have a way of reading the available balance using that balance opcode. So,
got it. Interesting. Very, very interesting. Like a lot of these things, I found that, you know, it's fun to think about ahead of time from our point of view, but like, there's no substitute for like going in and just like actually like doing it. And so, like right now we've got our like, you know, Paymaster stuff going and it like works with the asynchronous execution. We had to change some of the 4337 spec in order to like match the Monad stuff. But like, we're very much expecting to have to change it again. And so we're of the opinion that like with a lot of this stuff, you know, we're going to just keep iterating on it. And so we're very open to it.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear about the Paymaster stuff. I hadn't spent a lot of time thinking about that. So I think this is a productive discussion in terms of like giving me something else to think about over the weekend.
Well, dude, so like we knew that you guys were going to be making the change from gas use to gas limit because it would be really easy to like DDoS the chain or whatever if you didn't. And so like we had this like script ready to go. Like we had this like new smart contract ready to go. But we didn't know when you did it. And so what happened was like before, when you're running a bundler, you typically want to have like a really big gas limit so you don't have to simulate like the gas limits of like the underlying stuff. And so I think you guys put that change in at like midnight our time. And we didn't have pager duty set up yet for the gas balances of our bundlers. And overnight, every single one of our bundlers just drained its balance all the way to zero because our like refilling mechanism stopped working. And it's like we woke up and like we're like, oh shit. And so we deployed the like the new smart contracts, which thank God we already had like ready. And it was a fun moment where it was like, it was bad for us, but it was way worse for every other bundler because I think we were the only ones that like knew it was coming.
Was this on testnet or devnet?
Testnet. Testnet? Ooh, it's a good question, actually. I genuinely don't remember. I think testnet. Testnet, but I could be misremembering. I remember the change happened at like midnight or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, as everything matures, there'll be more sort of like notices about more community sort of collaboration on changes. But I just think no one could think of a good alternative to that gaming sort of problem. Yeah, besides just charging it. And I've always had general sort of concerns, you know, like when you're sending an aggressive order on an order book, you don't know how many passive orders you're going to match against, right? Like, you may match against one, you may match against 10, right? And so how do you, and somebody else's aggressive order lands before you, you know, so you can't even sort of predict, And so you have to pad out that gas to be able to match against those, you know, a certain number of passive orders. And so that you kind of, it does seem kind of off that you don't really know how much, or, you know, you end up spending, you don't know. So you have to just pad it out and then you get charged for that padding anyways. But I have not heard a good sort of alternative to this that really works.
The way that we're looking at it is that, like, it is an unfortunate side effect that people have to pay for the full gas limit, but at the same time, it allows like such larger blocks, and it allows like, you know, it takes the execution out of the hot path of consensus that, like, even if you're paying for the gas limit rather than the gas used, like, you're still paying way, 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 way less than you would pay if it was safe to, if you had like a design where people just paid for the gas used.
Yeah. I mean, the argument here again is just like Monash should be cheap to use anyway. So what's 0.0002 versus 0.0001 of a penny? It just doesn't, hopefully it doesn't matter. But and then the focus on sort of like transient sort of usage being cheap, order books, that sort of stuff that comes and goes storage wise, should just be cheap, and it should be cheap for market makers to make markets and that sort of thing. And or any sort of game that's any sort of action that's transient sort of data, you know, you play chess on chain, but then you like roll it up and delete the sort of like historical state and keep it, you know, like any of this sort of stuff is, as long as that's cheap, that I think that's a good sort of outcome. And then the accumulation of data should be expensive, right? It should be costly to store things permanently.
Are you guys thinking about changing the gas cost, or like the gas, like for instance, a storage write to an uninitialized slot or like a zero value slot is like, I think like roughly 20,000 gas, plus like a little bit extra. Like, are you guys thinking about adjusting those underlying opcode costs?
Yeah, that may change, but I, as I said, I think the sort of like the putting something in the state and keeping it there should kind of be a separate way of fees. And there's the actual storage of those values. Those things are actually really annoying, right? There's a lot of unconditional sort of rights, but the way the Ethereum sort of gas model works is you need to read it anyways to see like what the gas charge is going to be. So like setting something that's non-zero to zero, or setting something that's zero to non-zero, or all these sorts of actions, to kind of progress through the execution, you need to know what the previous value is, when in a lot of cases you just don't care. You just don't care what the previous value is. And, every store ends up being a read as well. And I'm not a big fan of the way that sort of gas stuff was designed because of that reason. You should be able to progress through execution, not really caring what the previous value was. And so we've thought about like technology ways of solving that. We've thought about gas changes to solve that, but yeah, we do not have that fully baked out cost wise.
Are you open to diverging from the Ethereum path?
We are open to diverging, yeah.
Bullish.
But I think probably the biggest impact divergence would be for, like I said, sort of like long-term storage refunds, that sort of thing, as opposed to S-Load S-Store. I really think storage should be the most costly thing is not sort of execution. I mean, except there are expensive sort of operations, but it's really like data transmission and storage, and you know, then you get your more expensive sort of cryptographic operations or chain sort of operations. I read storage slot. I read the value at this storage slot X, and then I use that value as my next location that I read storage. And you get some of these chain sort of operations that are sequential, and those are very expensive. And there's ways of dealing with that as well. But those are kind of where the major sort of changes should come from. Ethereum is just, you know, it's what, 12 second block times, not very much stuff. So they have tons of time. Like Ethereum has tons of time to do execution. And I'm pretty sure you could, if you sat around and thought about it, you could kind of construct transactions that would really bring down any of the L2s or L1s.
Yeah, that resonates with me. I think one of the things you just mentioned there also, like with regards to the data transmission, also resonates with me. And I think that like in Ethereum, there's definitely this mindset of, you know, storage is everything. And call data is relatively cheap, unless you're on an L2, in which case the call data kind of has to be compressed and then stored on the L1, which is why L2 call data is not necessarily cheap. But like for Monad, I mean, execution is so efficient. Like, are you guys looking at ways to, I don't want to say charge, that might be the wrong word, but like, are you guys looking at like ways to incorporate like the message propagation costs or like data transmission into the actual like fee mechanism or cost mechanism?
Because I think, well, like, right, I think that's sort of, that is your sort of intrinsic gas, right? The number of bytes and how compressible it is and all that sort of stuff. And we've thought about it. I wouldn't say we have any sort of immediate changes planned, but you know, this is an argument I've made about before about like access lists, for example. Like, is it better to discover the read, or is it better to like know ahead of time the read, and you know, and then save the data transmission of having to pass along the address and the storage address and all that sort of stuff. And so I've never been convinced I've never been convinced one way or the other that like maybe actually just discovering it locally is cheaper than transmitting it over the network. Monad has also just tried to been like network sort of efficient, right? We've set the spec at like 100 megabit download for, you know, like a full node to keep up with a fully busy chain. And I think even like testnet is maybe set at half of that or something. And, you know, right now our Raptor encoding is kind of high. The ratio is kind of high. So you need to have more upstream bandwidth if you're a leader or a validator, but we've always kind of focused on, and maybe this is not the perfect path forward, because a lot of data center, you know, you can't really get a box in a data center with less than a gigabit connection these days. And, you know, even fiber is getting pretty prevalent in the US, you know, the Verizon fiber and all these different telecom fibers are, you know, you can get a gigabit of internet pretty easily at home as well, but just kind of going towards decentralization, we kind of set that number as 100 megabit originally.
That makes sense. That's awesome. That's cool. Well, dude, let me ask you this, as we're getting ready to wrap up the podcast. One of the things that everybody is always wanting to know is, you know, when mainnet. I'm not going to ask you that, but because I know obviously mainnet is imminent, but my question for you is like more from a technical design standpoint. What would you like to see in place, robust and tested, before you would feel comfortable launching mainnet? And like specifically, like what stuff maybe isn't available on testnet right now that you would like to see, that you would like to feel comfortable with before you would feel comfortable like turning mainnet on?
Yeah, you mentioned earlier some of the things like peer discovery, the staking. So there's some stuff in testnet that's just the dynamic nature of the chain being set up needs to be well tested in testnet. You know, the streaming sort of events. I don't know if you guys are using the streaming events yet, or you know, the WebSocket stuff is kind of being tested now. There's a lot of integrations around that. You know, a lot of the infra providers use like polling methods for, they try to pull the entire block, you know, like this just doesn't work in sort of a high throughput chain. And so, There's more infrastructure around. And this is just something that I've mentioned on Twitter before as well. We just didn't do a good job. We always focus on the chain. We always focus on consensus and execution. We spent very little like thought to RPC and sort of all the integrations that go. And, you know, I just never even really occurred to me how much actual off-chain infrastructure there is to the running, right? And everyone has to kind of be up to speed, and you can only optimize things so much. You know, you just it's not possible to use polling in a lot of cases on a high throughput chain and that sort of stuff. And so it's not just Monad that has to adapt, it's some of the app people as well. And I think other high performance chains recently, I've seen them mention this on Twitter as well. It's kind of a pain point for the entire industry, I think, as we scale up. It's just, you know, all the back end infrastructure that worked on Ethereum doesn't work on any sort of like high throughput. And so there's that. And yeah, I mean, mainnet is imminent, depending on how you define imminent. It's, you know, we're moving as quickly as possible. There's, of course, code audits and other sort of boxes that need to be checked that you're working on other people's sort of timelines. You know, I would love to press the button and go to mainnet today, but you know, that wouldn't be like a wise decision. We need to get the sign off of the other sorts of people and other teams and external vendors and stuff like that. So as soon as we can get the sign off from everyone that's involved, and yeah, then we'll launch.
Hell yeah.
Well, Foundation will launch on, you know, on the tech side. Yeah. You know, it's just like, from what we can do is just, the main thing is security, right? Like, if you launch and there's a major hack and people are minting USDC like crazy on chain, you know, that's the death of a project. So it's better to take our time, make sure things are right, than to try to rush things. And there's never a perfect time to launch. You know, there's app teams that have been waiting for us to launch for a long time. There's app teams that are not ready yet, right? So we're going to launch with some app teams not ready, and we're going to launch with some app teams that are, have been waiting, chomping at the bit for a long time. So it's just, there's never going to be a perfect sort of time. You just need to like make sure everything's nicely completed and done, and Mono launch it.
Oh yeah. Well, dude, James, thank you so much for coming on the pod. We really appreciate your insight and your candor. This was super informative. I learned a lot. I can't wait to go back and digest this, and to, especially with like some of the accounting stuff. This is really, really interesting to me. But dude, thank you so much, man. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me. And you got some ideas in my head that I'm going to think about over the weekend. And so we'll keep in touch. Yeah.